This episode of Unscripted was recorded prior to the UK government's announcement that it's cutting financial support to the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, of which Rotary is a proud founding member. To read Rotary Great Britain and Ireland's statement on the UK government's polio funding, please visit rotarygbi.org or read the latest issue of Rotary magazine.
Hello, I'm Dave King.
And I'm Alicia Reed. Welcome to Rotary Unscripted, the official podcast of Rotary magazine for Great Britain and Ireland.
And we're recording once again from the studios of Swindon 105.5 with its own bus stop. And we have our thanks to, as always, to the team here for keeping everything running smoothly and occasionally reminding us that radio doesn't always run 2 o'clock.
We've got a packed programme as usual for you today, and joining us we have Rotary International Director Harriet Vervey, who represents a Rotary region which includes our home patch right here of Great Britain and Ireland.
You got that pronouncement really well.
Thank you.
We'll also be speaking in Donaghadee, sunny Donaghadee, to Garth Arnold, the past chair of Rotary in Great Britain and Ireland, who has been closely involved in Ireland's successful bid to host the Rotary International Convention in Dublin in 2031.
And later in the programme, we'll welcome David Welsh from the Rotary Club of Ilminster about a project helping communities respond to flooding in Somerset. And there's also a little bit of a bonus in this episode. Ooh, getting excited now. So during a recent End Polio Now event at the Palace of Westminster, Dave managed to catch up with Rotary International President Francesco Arezzo, as well as one of our past guests, Dr. Jamal Ahmed, the Polio Director at the World Health Organization.
So 5 conversations, plus a couple of special recordings showing Rotary at work internationally, nationally and locally in this specially extended edition of Rotary Unscripted. So our first guest is Harriet Vervey, the Rotary International Director for Zones 19 and 20, which includes Great Britain and Ireland. Harriet lives in the historic Dutch city of Leiden, home to the oldest university in Netherlands. I have done my research. And before her Rotary leadership journey, she had an extraordinary medical career. Harriet trained as a cardiologist, specialising in chronic heart failure and cardiac transplantation at the Leiden University Medical Centre. And she also founded the Women's Heart Movement, seeking better understanding and treatment of heart disease in women. Harriet joined Rotary in 2002, later serving as a district governor and a regional Rotary Foundation coordinator before becoming Rotary International Director. And I should say that I bumped into Harriet a couple of times recently. We met once at a Rotary event at Warwick University. Food was pretty good, wasn't it? And again at the Houses of Parliament, which probably tells you something about how busy Harriet's schedule is. So Harriet, welcome to Rotary Unscripted.
Thank you very much, Dave, and I'm looking forward to have a nice chat with you and Lissy.
Oh, it sounds so fireside and good. Thank you very much. So, Harriet, you've had, well, it's a remarkable career. When we look at that CV, a remarkable career in medicine before taking on a sort of global leadership role in Rotary. But what first drew you to Rotary back in 2002?
Well, I was invited by one of my patients, and he was quite persistent. And eventually I went to a meeting just to get rid of him. And so being polite. So, OK, you have invited me. I will come to your meeting. And then the first time was a reception. And the second time was he said, oh, no, you don't have seen the club really, because it was a reception. Please come and join us on a regular meeting. So I did so. And then they were discussing a project, a music project for children born deaf. And I go like, impossible to let children who are born deaf experience music. But it was a special technique by giving them an air-filled balloon pressed through their belly. Through the vibrations, they could experience music. They didn't hear it, but they experienced music. And that was, for them, a life-changing event, but also for me. From that moment, I got hooked on Rotary, never to let go again.
Fantastic. Alyssa, you're the musician in the room. How does that sound?
I am absolutely fascinated by this, because obviously you hear about things like cochlear implants where people can hear in a different way, but a balloon to the belly. Goodness, that sounds absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and when the orchestra, the Philharmonic, the Dutch Philharmonic started to play, I can still vision the eye and imagine the eyes of the children. They became big and some were crying, and I was crying also because of their emotion.
Wow. It was wonderful. How old were these children, Harriet?
10 years.
Yeah.
And goodness. It's back about 24 years ago now, but it was 10 years then. Yeah, they were 10 years, yeah.
I've never heard of that before. Have
never
you?
In my life. I'm absolutely fascinated by that.
And so you.
That's what Rotary is.
Well, it is, isn't it? Rotary is full of surprises, isn't it? And there's one for you right on the plate. So you've had quite a varied Rotary career. What is Rotary like in Holland? Tell me a little bit about Rotary there.
Rotary in Holland. I think there are a lot of similarities. We have problems not to get members in, but to keep them in. Yeah? So the retention rate is quite a problem. And we also have problems getting the young people into Rotary or Rotaract. So the problems are quite similar to Great Britain and Ireland. But there's one thing, and I don't know if that is particularly for the Dutch, but we don't like to say what we are doing. We are kind of... We ought to, because we are privileged. Just today, President Francesco was in the Netherlands, and we were talking about his experience going around the globe. And I said, particularly the Dutch, they go like, don't brag about what you are doing. To me, it's not bragging. If you don't tell it, how would people know what Rotary can do? So that is one thing we have to get rid of it.
It is a problem, isn't it? Because they talk about Rotary being one of the world's best kept secrets, because there's that humbleness in what Rotarians do and are perhaps not really prepared to sing about it. So how do we change those attitudes?
First of all, we have to have a strong public image. That is very important to show it. Even if you don't want to tell it, show it. Show the projects. And that is why I'm very looking forward to hear from the Somerset flooding project. Show it, and then people know where they can find help and who can help them. So, and I was born in Suriname, South America. We are not shy. We are like, go tell it on the mountain.
go tell it on the mountain.
To educate them to do that.
Fantastic. So just take me through some of the highlights of your Rotary career in Holland, or is it the Netherlands? Should I say the Netherlands or the Holland? I'm never quite sure which.
When you say Holland, you mean North and South, the two provinces, North and South Holland. When you say the Netherlands, it's all.
Okay. So in the Netherlands, Rotary in Netherlands, in your experience there, what have been some of the highlights, the things that have really sort of like galvanized you with your Rotary work?
Well, first of all, as I was talking about the experience with those children, the born deaf children. And the second is, when you do something together, the fellowship among the Rotarians, among the club members, that is something is unbelievable. So that is the second. And the third thing, in my career, I was used to go to big conferences, cardiology conferences, usually 25 to 30,000 people attending it. But when someone come and talk to you, they always want something from you. But when you are in Rotary, whether it's small or large meeting, it is like, oh yeah, we are family. The engagement, being involved with what you are doing, that's fantastic. And that's all around the globe. I've been to several countries. I've traveled a lot from my job as a doctor and being a university cardiologist. So I had to travel a lot. But everywhere, that's the difference. When I come in as a Rotarian, you're so welcome. And now also in my new role as director from Great Britain and Ireland, everybody welcomed me. Garth, it was one of them, driving me around to showcase me what Ireland is. So it was magnificent, really, very good.
What did you make? I mean, Garth is listening. What did you make of Ireland?
Me?
Yeah, what did you make of Ireland? When Garth showed you around to Uncle Patrick, what did you make of it?
Oh, it's a beautiful island. Yeah, it's a beautiful island. I love it. The people are very nice. They were very friendly to me. And yes, and I've tasted some Irish things, but it was good.
Guinness?
Yes.
Did you have
any? No, I don't. I like to go stand on my feet, you know, so I skipped that part.
Yeah. And what possessed you to become Rotary International Director? Was it a mad moment?
A mad moment in a way. But when you have this rotating system, and when the Netherlands was overturned to elected a director, people start calling me and say, Harriet, you are the perfect person to represent the Netherlands. And in the beginning, I was like, leave me alone. I'm doing my own thing, minding my own business, and that is okay with me. But then later on, and as I read more about it, I go like, yes, I might be a good representative of my ambassador, a good ambassador of my country and of Rotary International as a whole. I must say, until you're in the battle, then you know what it really is.
Yeah.
So it's more than I had expected, but the joy, and also to get to know people, to meet people, to get inspired. Yes, it's worth it.
So what sort of role is it, Harriet? Is it an ambassadorial role, or is it very much, are you practically involved in working with associations around Europe, in Great Britain and Ireland, and also in Europe itself? What does that role entail?
Well, I have two hats on, to say. One is being the Rotary International Director, being in the board of Rotary International. We are policymakers. We are thinking about the future of Rotary, where is Rotary going to, because it is a global organization. In the board, I'm simply there for the future of Rotary, making policies. I'm not thinking about what is good for the Netherlands. No, I'm thinking globally. When I'm in the Netherlands or in Great Britain and Ireland or in Spain, Portugal, which I am also responsible for, then I'm more locally. Which parts of these new policies benefits you the most? Then I'm thinking locally. So in one way, I'm thinking globally, being a policymaker for the organization as a whole. And I try to bring and make it tailor-made for those parts where I'm responsible for.
So you're clocking up a few miles then?
Pardon?
You're clocking up a few miles all over Europe.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
And I know that one of the recent initiatives that's come out of Rotary International, and I guess you were perhaps part of this decision, is this goal of membership of 1.5 million by 2030. Is that correct?
The goal is not 1.5, because I don't think we can reach that in 5 years. It is 1,250,000 members,
right,
by 2030, because then Rotary is celebrating its 125th anniversary.
So what do you think of that as a target? Do you think that's an achievable target? Because we're seeing this immense growth in Asia, particularly in India. And we'll talk about Great Britain and Ireland shortly, where we do have problems with membership growth. But do you think that's a realistic target?
Yes, we have 1,114,000 or something, something around that. So I think we have to increase 40,000 and 20,000 annually to get this number in total. So yes, I think it's achievable. And right now we are getting more and more aware of the urgency to find not only new members, to induct clubs new style, and to get the young people the transitioning from Rotaract into Rotary. These three things are now on the agenda, and that is where we are working hard on. So I think it's achievable and as a whole. And I'm very optimistic about it. You know, when the foundation said we will have by 2025 $2 billion, $25 million, everyone goes like a cuckoo, it will not happen. Well, they surpassed it. It was $2 billion, $60 million, and not 25, but $60 million upon the target. So yes, I think we will achieve it. But we have to do work, and work is, like I say, get people engaged, new style clubs, not doing the same and expecting that we will improve the numbers, because that will not happen. So we have to think differently. We dare to be different. We had to have the guts, the courage to get out of the chair and do something crazy, something completely mad. And that will help us get the young ones on board, because then they have a different perspective of what Rotary is.
We're recording this program from the studios of Swindon 105.5, whose slogan is Dare to be Different. So there you go. Just one final question. When I met you at Warwick, you were telling a great story, and this shows the sort of lady you must be and the drive you must have, because you were sort of equating it to how Rotary has got to drive membership, that you were very driven as a cardiologist to meet those targets, and you had this little competition going on as a cardiologist. I don't know how you had the heart to do it. But anyway, could you perhaps sort of tell that story about that competition you had?
Oh, yes. I was the deputy of the Heart-Lung Center at the University Hospital in Leiden. And every year we had to have a program also aligned with a budget, and then talk with the insurance companies. And for many years, we were doing the same numbers of procedures. Then one day, me and a couple of others, but as being one of the leaders, I said, okay, next year we will do not 900, but we will do 1100. And they go like, impossible. We never passed the target, or sometimes even didn't meet the target, so it's impossible. I said, yes, yet we will do 1100. So the next year, the target was 1100. We didn't reach the 1100. We were slightly below, but the fact that we came so close, it raised something like energy in the team. So the next year I say 1200, and so every year, and then at the end, after 3 years, my team wanted to win the bid from me. So before I could say the number, they go like, raise the bar, and then they say the number they wanted to reach. And from that moment on, we have always reached or even surpassed the numbers, because the team was so engaged and they wanted to win from me. So, raise the bar.
Harriet, I think we have to say a big thank you to your persistent patient, because as a result of their persistence, we have your magic to join us in Rotary. So thank you to the persistent patient.
Our connections make powerful things happen, uniting individuals and communities. We are Rotary. We are people of action. With over 1 million members, we know what people can do when they come together. Around the world, generations of leaders build new friendships and solve problems, turning great ideas into reality. Take action with us. Find out more at rotary.org/action.
Now, we welcome Garth Arnold. So, he brings with him an exciting story for Rotary in Ireland. Garth is a Rotarian from Northern Ireland and a past chair of Rotary in Great Britain and Ireland. And he's been closely involved in Ireland's successful bid to host the Rotary International Convention in Dublin in 2031. And that's an event that will bring tens of thousands of Rotarians from around the world right here to the Irish capital. For anyone who's attended one of Rotary's international conventions, they're remarkable gatherings, and they bring together Rotary's global community for learning, inspiration and friendship. Garth, welcome to Rotary Unscripted.
Thanks, Alicia. Lovely to be here.
And I have a particular soft spot for Ireland, so it's a great honour to speak to you. For listeners who may not realise just how significant this is, How big a moment is it for Ireland to secure the 2031 International Convention?
It's wonderful news, but I suppose we're sort of unique in the island because our district actually covers the whole island of Ireland. So it covers both north and south. And I suppose we're one of the few districts where the border doesn't exist, so to speak. So we sort of run right across. And I suppose if anybody's familiar with the history of Ireland, that sort of makes it very unique. And we sort of all sort of work well and gel together. So the whole piece about the convention and trying to sell that has been a whole team effort from the whole island of Ireland. And I suppose when we're looking at it and selling the piece of Dublin, we're sort of trying to sell the north of the island as well. So maybe people will, if they're coming from the mainland, and our colleagues in the UK and come across, they might come in through Belfast and travel down, or come across in the boat. Our Scottish people will come on the boat, or vice versa. A lot of people will come and look for their ancestors and stay for a little bit longer. The journey of us, I suppose, began way back in June 2024, when our district governor, Kenny Fisher, got a note from Rotary International asking would we like our name to go forward. So as Harry would know, and some of those know, you do get an opportunity sometimes to put your name forward if you're interested, but sometimes it comes the other way where the board will actually maybe come up with some names or some cities and then you get asked. So we actually got asked. We actually tried before a number of years ago, and Ireland put their name forward, and it was either us or the World Cup, and the government decided that they would put their money towards the World Cup, and guess what? We got neither. So so anyway, we were all a bit nervous about going forward, but we decided in June 24 to let our name go forward, and then the journey began.
So it's wonderful what you say about the Emerald Isle as it is, being a whole community across the borders. Yeah. And like you say, that's quite a unique thing, isn't it? Yeah. I can't think of anywhere else that perhaps has that same dynamic and the bringing together of history. For yourself, did you always feel that gelling of cultures? How long have you been a Rotarian?
I've been involved in Rotary for over 30 years. I was in the banking career before I retired about 9 years ago, and I worked in a town called Newton Orange, which is just not far from Donaghadee. And one of our farming customers came in, and I worked on the counter at that stage. And the farming customer, who I knew quite well, the late John Warden, asked me would I like to join Rotary and join the Rotary Club of Donaghadee. So I'm a founder member of Rotary Club of Donaghadee, and I suppose the rest is history, and that's where that started.
Similar situation to Harriet. It's a patient who came to her, and it's the people, you know, just to talk about it. So in terms of how significant this is for the island of Ireland, then, to host the International Convention, what do you hope that Ireland in particular brings to the whole tradition of the International Conventions?
Yeah, well, I suppose if we go back to that there, it will be the biggest convention that the island has seen. We've worked very closely with the Dublin Convention Bureau, and I suppose the whole piece that we've sort of been selling it on has been working together. We've worked very closely with them, the RDS, which is known as the Royal Dublin Society, which is where the event will take place, which is sort of famous for the Dublin Horse Show, if anybody's into horses and things like that. It's held every year. And then working with Fáilte Ireland, and then our colleagues up in the north as well that are involved in the tourist board, and then we've worked with the local government as well. But I suppose probably one of the things that the team that visited sort of saw that we actually work so closely together that it's, you know, to get decisions and things like that, which maybe in some other parts of the world is harder to work through government. But we sort of have that there, and I thought we put on a very good presentation of what we actually can bring to the delegates that really want to come along. So
yes, and I'm wondering when we can bagsy our places on that convention. I can't wait for that. I'm definitely intending to be there in Dublin.
That was probably some of the things that worried some of our own people, because we had a few dates that we were going for, and you know, when we're sort of bringing our Rotarians along and sort of keeping them updated, and we were looking at sort of 2029 and 2031, even 32. So it was, you know, go back and tell them, yes, we've won, but it's a few more years yet. That's 2031, and then some people say, oh, maybe we won't be here. But anyway, it'll be brilliant for the island, brilliant for Rotary, and even brilliant, I think, for Rotary Great Britain and Ireland as well, because you say I did spend some time on as chair of the inaugural board, and we actually have a couple of people and Steve Martin, who actually Harriet will know. Steve will be taking over from Harriet when she finishes her term. Steve is on our host organising committee, and Phil Dyer, who some of you might know, is involved in the public image as well. He's on our host organising committee as well. So we started early with making sure we had people from all parts on the team.
Just as a plug, Garth, we've got Steve on the next episode. Next episode.
Oh, have you?
We've got him on with Francesco, but we've got him talking football.
He's actually buzzing. He was buzzing about it actually coming to Ireland, because you sort of, as I sort of said to Alicia over there, on the journey that we went along, we sort of, you know, we were able to put her name in, and then you go through it and you put the bid in and you think, oh, well, you've done that thing, it's good. And then you go a bit further, and then you say you've been shortlisted and say, oh, okay, we're all right. And then go a bit further, and you've got the site visit. And, oh, sure, if you don't get any further, it'll be all right. And then you get the final thing that you said you've been tentatively, you know, selected. So, you know, you sort of...
Just to ask quickly, what sort of numbers are you expecting in terms of visitors for 2031?
Yeah, well,
and the second part is, clearly you've given some numbers to Rotary International. From an economy point of view, how much do you think this is going the convention is going to help the economy in Dublin and the greater part of Ireland?
Well, I'll start with that first because of the figures. So the convention board worked out 68 million euros for the local economy.
Wow.
for the convention coming. Sorry, David, what was that?
So you're saying the convention will generate 68 million euros.
Yep.
And that would be based on how many visitors are you...
The target number is that the use for European for conventions is 17,000, but we're hoping for up to 20,000.
Wow.
And I saw there that Barcelona had a little piece on Facebook the other day, because they've got 2029 there. They're hoping for the 20,000 figure as well.
What I would love to hope for is that there's quite a young demographic attending in Dublin. So are there any plans to involve some younger people in the event planning, etc.?
Yes, I've got a number of Rotaract and younger people in the HOC, and actually we're doing you'll all be familiar with direct membership, and I'm the hub coordinator for Ireland, and we're running a membership campaign at the moment. So we've got about 11 new members. If we get in through the membership campaign, we've 40 members in the hub, but a lot of those people are young people with brilliant skills, and we'll be hoping to have already tapped a few of them on the shoulder to join the team.
And so, 5 years sounds quite a long time in the future, but really it passes quickly, doesn't it? And by then, hopefully, we've had more young input to help influence the way Rotary works.
Yes, I mean it's exciting, and it's great that we have a bit of a pipeline of the younger people coming through, which is really good.
And are you going to be there?
I am.
Yes. Well, I'll see you there. And Harriet's put the thumb up as well. Yes.
Definitely. I'll be there.
Excellent.
Even though I'm then past director, I will be there.
I just think it's fantastic, Garth. I think it's fantastic that Ireland's got it. I know London tried a few years ago to get it, was unsuccessful. I think Melbourne got it instead. But to have it in Ireland is just perfect. And to be able to showcase the amazing events and the projects that, Ireland does will be amazing, and certainly it will hopefully be another sort of string to the bow in promoting membership, because that will be something great, because many people can't get to conventions. So the opportunity to come to a convention which is close by and easy to access will be fantastic. So, no, good luck to you there.
I mean, we haven't had anything locally since Hamburg.
Hamburg,
now we've got two very close in the space of a few years, which is brilliant.
Garth, stay with us. Thank you very much for that. Now, earlier in the programme, we mentioned an event held at the Palace of Westminster in March where Rotarians gathered with members of Parliament, diplomats and global health leaders to highlight Rotary's work to end polio now. Now, while I was there, I managed to catch up with two people who are closely involved in the global effort to eradicate polio. First, we have Rotary International President Francesco Arezzo, and after that, Dr. Jamal Ahmed, the polio director at the World Health Organization, who listeners may remember joined us for Rotary Unscripted in November. So first, let's hear from Francesco Arezzo. Francesco, welcome to London. This is part of a week-long visit to the UK. And I know last week you were at Rotary Great Britain and Ireland headquarters at Ulster, and you met some district governors and you met Amanda Watkin, the General Secretary. What did you find there?
I found a great commitment for the future of Rotary in this region, because, as you know, here we have one of the two pilot projects, and I was very curious to know how local Rotary is facing this new problem. And they are working a lot about two things, two new forms to involve people in Rotary. One is the direct membership, mm-hmm. and the other one is the enterprise membership. Both of them, I met also some Rotarians that are now direct members.
Yeah.
And also a company where they are trying the an enterprise membership. It is a great experiment, and it is going well.
Yeah.
It has, in my opinion, a good future, and I am sure that in the future we can count on this new form of membership. There is only a problem. That the results of this kind of experiment probably will arrive in the medium term, not immediately, but we have to wait 3, 4, probably 5 years to have a good result about this experiment. But in United Kingdom, we have a problem now, immediately. We are suffering with membership a lot. We are losing a lot of members in the last years. And so I think that we have to act in two different ways. Going forward with the experiment that is so good, very good, I like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, we have to do something immediately for the membership. Mm. So we need... Extremely, we need new clubs in this moment in United Kingdom. But not only new clubs, new ways, new types of clubs.
Mm.
Something of really very new, to involve the new generation. That is the problem.
I mean, you've been in the post now for, 9 months as Rotary International President, and you've travelled the world.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've seen on your travels in terms of membership growth, which could perhaps be repeated not only in the United Kingdom, but also around the world? Is there anything perhaps you've seen there?
It is always very difficult to reply the same kind of membership in another country, because every country is different. For example, what you see in India is... You cannot repeat in other countries, because their culture is different, the approach to Rotary is different, traditions are different, and also the situation of the middle class is different, because Rotary is the typical expression of the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And where the middle class is suffering, like in the Western societies in these times, Rotary is suffering.
Yeah.
While in India, in Africa, in other countries, the middle class in this moment is exploding.
Yeah.
And so it is easier for them. But, for example, what I saw in India that probably is important, and this is important, in my opinion, especially here in the United Kingdom, when they found a new Rotary Club, they always found also a Rotaract Club and an Interact Club.
Right.
Always. Mm. We don't have Rotaract Clubs in United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Only 29, 28 in all the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
We have 80 only in Sicily.
80 in Sicily?
80.
Wow.
80 also only in Sicily.
Mm.
So you don't have the youth clubs.
Mm.
You don't have Rotaract, some.
Yeah.
You don't have Interact. So I think that you have to begin. But again, this is something that will bring the result in the years.
Sure.
But I think that you have to found new clubs, new forms of clubs that could be more apt to the country, but you need something of new, and you need to involve the new generations much more.
So you're here in London right now. You've got a meeting tonight at the Houses of Parliament to do with polio. Were you at Westminster Abbey yesterday for the Commonwealth Day? Did you go to that?
Yes, the Commonwealth event was really very, very interesting. Also for me, I am not in the Commonwealth, of course. I come from Italy, but was really very good, very beautiful, and it is impressive to see 56 different countries that work together, that meet and they speak, and they always have something. They arrive to a decision together. Mm. That is remarkable. It is something that is very important. It is in the spirit of Rotary.
Of course it is. And then in terms of polio, we've got this meeting tonight. We've got some important figures from the World Health Organization coming along to talk to Rotarians in Great Britain and Ireland. What are you expecting to hear? What sort of messages are you hearing from the World Health Organization about polio?
About polio, the message is always the same. We really, in this moment, we are very near to finish the campaign, because the situation, despite the number of the case of the new cases that were about 40 last year, but we are in a very good position. The virus is isolated in a very small part of the two countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan, but the large part of the countries is free. So it is a very positive situation in this moment. We can finish. We really can finish in a couple of years.
Yeah.
What is dangerous in this moment is to lose the idea that we haven't finished.
Yeah.
And the people in Italy, for example, but in all the Western society, they already think that polio is done,
It's
not a problem. And they tend to not to have a good rate of vaccination, of immunization. And that is a big danger.
Yeah.
We risk to have another spread out of the virus, because our rate of vaccination is becoming lower and lower in the years. We have to maintain a very high rate of immunization in our countries.
Because we had a scare in London about 4 years ago, and there was one, I think, in Israel.
In New York, in Germany.
Yeah, so it sharpens the focus, maybe, that polio is just a flight away.
Virus travels without passports.
Yeah.
You never know when virus is arriving by a plane, by a boat. We have to maintain a high rate of attention toward the virus.
Yeah.
That is essential to finish really the campaign.
Final question. So a year ago, You were very happy in your Rotary. You were looking forward to a very quiet year ahead, and suddenly lands the RI presidency. So how has it been the last year, and how do you reflect on this sort of the quickness of having to get used to the role?
I have to say that when I received the call by Stephanie announcing that I was selected to be the next president, the first reaction was, no, I cannot. I refuse. I was very afraid, because I wasn't prepared. I already had the theme of the year, was already done.
Yeah.
We have the action plan, so it was easy to enter.
Yeah.
To enter in a plan that was already done, in the action plan of the year. And it was so important to have the cooperation. I had a very good cooperation by the board.
Yeah.
I cannot finish to thank the friends in the board that were all very supportive. And the support of the staff.
Yeah.
The staff was conscious of my and they were all very supportive. And then what was really the bad thing of the year was the great affection of the Rotarians.
Yeah.
Everywhere I went, I was welcomed with a great affection. And
lovely.
That was
the
most important thing that supported me in the first month particularly.
Yeah. And what did your family think?
I ran my clinic with my daughter, and when my daughter knew that I was going to become the president, international president, she began to cry because she realized that now she had to remain alone. But it was just the reaction of one day.
Yeah.
And then all of them, especially my wife, has supported me con grande affetto, trasporto.
Lots of affection and support.
Fantastic.
Without the family, you cannot. Mm.
And what has there been a family? Has there been an arrangement? Has there been something that you were expecting to do this year that you've had to put on the back burner, that you've had to cancel?
I don't know. I know I am trying to do everything I can. It was impossible to plan for a long time because the time to organize a minimum of I had a very short time.
Yeah.
But I am sure that. That we have done a lot of things.
Yeah.
We have done a lot of things, and we still could do a lot of things in the last two or three months that I still have. Yes, the most important thing that we did was during the assembly,
mm-hmm.
where I, Inca, the president-elect, and the president nominee, Larry.
Mm.
We were together on the stage, and we declared together that we are working like a team. We are working together. It is not my year or the year of Inca, but we are working for Rotary International. And this is the message that we want to give to the governors and to the club presidents, that nobody has to work for his year, because it's never is here, but we have to work always together in continuity for the best of Rotary International.
Francesco Arezzo, thank you very much.
And now Dave's chat with Dr. Jamal Ahmed from the World Health Organization.
Jamal, welcome to London. You're here for the End Polio Now event at Westminster. How much are you looking forward to that?
Absolutely looking forward to it. It's wonderful to be here in the UK. The UK has been a strong supporter of polio eradication for a while. Rotarians in the UK have been pushing also for this mission. I'm really looking forward to engaging with the MPs.
Now, you're going to be speaking tonight. What are some of the key messages that you're going to be making to Rotarians, to MPs, and actually High Commissioners will be there as well? What sort of messages will you be delivering?
My core message is that, one, we have come a long way, and we can't allow us to slide back. And then, two, we can deliver zero polio in the world, because it's really in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's cornered in those two countries. And despite all the challenges that we have faced over the last few years, and despite the potential challenges we are facing with everything that's going on now within the global health system, we still have to remain committed to ending polio for the sake of the work that has been done over many decades by generations before us, and for the sake of the children alive today and yet to be born.
We live in a world of conflict. How much more difficult does that make the work of the World Health Organization?
The virus, actually, the biggest challenge has been political, geopolitical, not the vaccine, not the technical know-how. We've known how to end polio for a while. The political challenges, the insecurity has been the reason why we've struggled over time. And that's why, actually, the virus is surviving along the borderlands between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So, yes, it's challenging, but we have been able to knock out transmission in other areas that are also challenging. So our work is about, despite the challenges, figuring out how to reach every child in every little village.
I know you had a meeting this morning with the Pakistan High Commission. Can you say very much about how that discussion went with them?
It was an excellent conversation with the High Commissioner. He's been he received us very well. And Pakistan is one of the last two endemic countries. We did have a conversation around how to, you know, ensure that even from London, as the High Commissioner, you know, continues to do his work in London, how he can help with the advocacy for polio eradication, and especially in Pakistan.
How has the most recent eradication, the most recent inoculation programs gone in Pakistan and in India? Have they been successful?
We just did one large-scale campaign at the beginning of February in Pakistan, and across the whole country. And that was very, very successful. We also we delivered also both in some geographies, in some targeted geographies. We used IPV, which is an inactivated polio vaccine, in some high transmission zones, both in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so we are at it. And there are two more campaigns coming before the end of spring, in April and then in May. So our goal is to reach every child and vaccinate every child.
And in Afghanistan, what's the situation there?
Afghanistan has made substantial progress, especially in eastern Afghanistan. There were areas that had seen consistent transmission that are now negative. Our challenges in southern Afghanistan, we've been at it with political advocacy. Personally, I've been to Afghanistan over the last 4 months twice, including in Kandahar and Helmand, which are the hotspots. And we've engaged at the local level with local governors, with local health departments, and we'll continue to see how we can bring communities together and how we can use every avenue, including NGOs and every other civil society group, to reach all the children in southern Afghanistan.
So what is the attitude of the Taliban government? Clearly, for you to be allowed into Afghanistan, that's one clear important step. How are they feeling? What are their thoughts about polio? Because in the past, they've prevented you from getting into those key areas. So is there a new attitude prevailing, or does it wax and wane?
Accessibility in southern Afghanistan has improved substantially. I was able to visit multiple districts using normal road transport. The de facto authorities are supportive, especially at the national level, but there are socio-cultural issues at the local level that we need to address. And that will require a deep engagement with local community elders and with local leadership at the district and the provincial level.
So there is that suspicion?
There is no suspicion of polio vaccination, not at all. It is the social habits of, you know, whether women can work freely, to reach, move freely, and so on.
Right.
That we need to navigate. That is our biggest obstacle at the moment.
So you talk about female vaccinators?
Female vaccinators going house to house, door to door. That's how traditionally we've been able to reach children in different areas, and there are restrictions around that in southern Afghanistan.
Because in a sense, when you crack Pakistan, when you crack Afghanistan, you're almost there.
We're done with type 1. We already finished two wild polio viruses, by the way, globally, type 2 and type 3. And so that means that's the next big milestone, finishing type 1 in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah. What about funding? This is obviously the big issue there. Is America still providing funding for polio or not?
The US is still engaged with the GPI and is providing support.
Right.
And we are figuring out on a day-to-day basis, literally, how to maximally utilize those resources,
right,
in a way that benefits not just the eradication effort, but also the health systems as a whole. They are still engaged within the GPEI, but we haven't figured out how to deliver those resources to the maximal, to the maximum benefit.
So, in terms of the funding generally, I know the recent assembly, there were some hard discussions held, some tough decisions to be made. Yeah. What does it look like in terms of meeting that shortfall? How is the World Health Organization going to be able to continue that work while trying to also address the shortfall in funding?
Hard choices have to be made through prioritizations and so on. But look, funding shortfall at the global level effectively means decreased support for the most vulnerable people in the world, whether they are in the Democratic Republic of Congo, whether it is in South Sudan and Sudan, or the Lake Chad Basin, or in Afghanistan and Pakistan or Yemen. And what that means is disease surveillance is a bit weaker because of that funding support. Our capacity to detect diseases and infectious diseases early on it will be affected. And ultimately, it's a lose-lose scenario for everybody because early detection is how we detect, not only for polio, but for all other pathogens. Early detection, early response is key to keeping everybody in the world safe. So this, to me, the global shift that we've seen over the last 1 year is short-sighted, and we will hopefully not pay a big price and we will come to our senses.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in terms of making that funding provision, is there any truth in the thoughts that maybe the World Health Organization might move away from its base in Geneva to, say, somewhere like Cairo?
No, that's not, there's no truth to that. The WHO is based in Geneva and the headquarters is in Geneva. We do have regional offices in Cairo for the Eastern Mediterranean region and regional offices in Brazzaville and in other places. That's how the structure works. There's no truth to any WHO entity shifting, WHO HQ shifting from Geneva.
Now, we were delighted to have you on the Unscripted podcast in the autumn and some really important messages there around World Polio Day. Mm. Now we're sort of 5 months hence. Times change. You've been to Afghanistan, and there's a whole range of issues on the table. Mm-hmm. What finally, Jamal, would be your message to Rotarians in Great Britain and Ireland?
Rotarians in the UK and Ireland have been the engine that has been pushing the world. The UK is a highly influential country, not just within Europe but globally. We need the United Kingdom to continue to stay the course. And my message to Rotarians across both the UK and Ireland, push forward for polio eradication and funding, push as hard as possible through all institutions, both national and supranational, to continue the support for polio eradication and global health in general.
Dr. Jamal Ahmed, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So that was Francesca Arezzo and Dr. Jamal Ahmed speaking at the End Polio Now event at the House of Commons in March. And it was, Alicia, a really fascinating gathering.
Have you been to the End Polio Now events at Westminster before?
Yeah, I mean, every year we hold the event. It's always during Commonwealth Week. So the President comes over, whoever it is, to join us. And it's so they spend the Monday at the Commonwealth church gathering at Westminster Abbey. And this year, Francesco, he met the King. He met King Charles, which is great. There's some pictures of him there at a reception afterwards. There's lots of Commonwealth leaders as well who join us. And then on the Tuesday, we all gather in his committee room in the sort of in the bowels of the House of Commons for this event. And we have the World Health Organization there, usually the president and a few other experts, and a gathering of Rotarians from across Great Britain and Ireland. And Harriet was there as well, where we had a chance to really hear from the experts about what's happening with polio. And what the future lies. And Harriet, what did you make of the gathering at Westminster in terms of what you heard from the experts? Do you remain hopeful?
Yes, indeed, I do remain hopeful. You know, what has impressed me most was this lady, the Paralympian,
Anna Wafula Strikes. Yes, the Paralympian. Anna Wafula. Yeah.
And when she said, if only I had the two drops at the age of two and a half years when she got polio, she contracted polio when she was 2 years old, something like that. It brought me back to India when I was there to do the vaccination and seeing all these children now grown up who didn't have the chance to be vaccinated, living in the dirt, dragging their lower body part through the dust. I go like, we have to. The problem is it takes quite a couple of years, decades, to get rid of polio. And in the Western world and the United States as well, we haven't seen victims of polio. And that's why most of the time people think, what are we fighting against? Mm. What are we fighting against? Because we don't see these victims. And so I remain hopeful. But I also think that people like Anna has to have a broader, okay, she's doing the Paralympic, that is great, but I think her voice is more powerful than all the numbers that we show, because she can tell you what it means, having contracted polio at a very young age. She managed to escape, she managed to have a future, although in the wheelchair. So I'm hopeful. I think we have to push through and never give up, because we promise it to the children of this world. But I also think that people like Anna should have more opportunity to tell their story. It blows me off my socks that evening to see her sitting there.
And Harriet, when you've been travelling around, do you ever find that there's resistance to taking the vaccine when it's offered?
In the Western world, yes, and in general, we see the vaccination rate going down. And that's why now, every now and then, we have this eruption, whether it be measles or something like that, chickenpox. The people refuse to have these vaccinations or give it to their children, I must say. And that is a serious problem. And the vaccination rate is going down dramatically in the Western world. And the second thing is, polio is everywhere. Recently, it was found in the wastewater samples from Germany. Mm. So these are our neighbors. And so we have to be careful and cautious that this thing is around the corner, because we're traveling so extensively. You can easily get it there and bring it to your home country and get other people infected. Well, you don't know that you are a carrier.
Doesn't it just show that we really do need to keep this work up, and all the wonderful work that is being done worldwide is a testament to our efforts as Rotarians. And Garth, Rotary clubs across Ireland and Great Britain, they've been supporting the End Polio Now campaign for decades. So from your perspective, what does this campaign say about Rotary's ability to mobilise people from around the world for this common cause?
Yeah, well, I think it's just interesting. We had a session last night with a membership on a Rotary Foundation session last night, just locally for the clubs in Northern Ireland. And, you know, I think we had over 20 clubs with about 60 people in the room. And we sort of split that up between membership and foundation, and we had a good polio piece on that. But you have to keep, I think as Harriet says, you have to keep pushing and you know, chipping away at it, because they sort of just think sometimes that it's, you know, why do we have to keep giving, and we buy the crocuses and we do all the things in the local schools. But it's I think they're talking about maybe trying to have it eradicated by 2030. Is that something they've been talking about? That was something I thought I picked up.
The goal is 2030, because they hope that after 2026 we will never have a new case, and then you have to wait 3 more years before you can say the world is where polio is eradicated. So it's 2030.
Well, so we were linking that back to the convention and being in Ireland in 2031 and trying to celebrate.
We're going
like that.
To celebrate.
Yes, correct.
Exactly.
But that's how we were pushing it.
Yep.
That's how we were pushing it last night.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds a wonderful target to aim for. Well, let's bring in David Welsh now, our final guest. And he brings us right down to club-level Rotarians as people of action. David Welsh is a member of the Rotary Club of Ilminster in Somerset, and they've been involved in a project supporting the Emergency Volunteer Action Group, helping communities affected by flooding. As we probably know, flooding has become an increasingly serious issue around parts of the UK, and local volunteer groups often play a crucial role in supporting communities during those emergencies. So, working alongside partners and volunteers, this project has helped coordinate support and equipment and practical assistance for people affected by flooding in their region. David, a warm welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, for those listening who may not know about this project, can you explain what the Emergency Volunteer Action Group does and how Rotary became involved?
Yes, it started in 2014 when there was a massive flood in Somerset, 25 square miles of water, 5 feet deep, 3 villages wiped out. And we were asked to man a warehouse for donations. Donations were coming in so fast on HGVs, trucks loads, that we had to get over 100 Rotarians in to man it with 8 Rotarians a day for 3 months. And many of them repeated, and in a wheel came in with them. And we ran that warehouse for those 3 months. Then we raised £150,000 nationally to help those who were underinsured or not insured. And then when all the dust settled and we moved to another warehouse, there were a lot of packing cases we hadn't yet opened. And in those packing cases were donations of kit to protect households against floods. In the meantime, we were also invited by the 3 counties that our district covers, Somerset, Wiltshire and Dorset, to be available as manpower for emergencies, to be called out to run evacuation centres. And we've been called out several times in the middle of the night. We've gone out and entertained the evacuees who are being brought in by the fire brigade and the police when their homes have been evacuated. And then we serve them breakfast, give them as good a time as possible. But the flood program started because once we'd found this kit, we thought, "What now? What do we do?" There were 2,000 items, some of the United States, some UK. What do we do with it? So we thought we'd try to distribute it. And we struggled for a while until a government organization called Somerset Prepared came forward and said, "Look, we'll help you to distribute it and we'll pay 80% of the cost, because we know you'll need to replace equipment." So we've been running that now. We've done about 200 homes in Somerset. We hold conventions in each village. And in each village, we tell people, if you give us your name and address, we promise we'll visit your house. We visit the house. We survey it. We assess the needs, look to see where the floodwater comes in. And we have 12 assorted types of kit in the vehicle, and we issue it there and then, and protect the home. And we've got experience now of homes which we have protected, and the flood came afterwards, and people have phoned us to say, "Your kit worked," which is a great relief to us to know that it did.
What an incredible achievement. So, and it sounds like on that initial time when you were asked to help just help on that day, which turned into weeks, which turned into months. You quickly had to learn on the spot where to put your manpower and your resources. So how long between that first day was it until you realised, actually, we need to organise ourselves into a task group here?
It happened by a sort of remarkable process of coincidence. First of all, on the first day I went up to the warehouse, I didn't know how to get Rotarians, and I ran out of phone calls after 2 days. Then I had a bright idea, adopt a day, and I invited clubs to adopt a day and come in as a club to run the warehouse. And clubs immediately signed up for the next 4 weeks, and I had the next 4 weeks full. So the clubs were excellent, and they did a really good job when they came in and ran the warehouse. And then the breakthrough for the organization that we are now came when the three counties phoned me and said, we've heard what you're doing. We want you to join our committees where we prepare for resilience and to meet the needs of major incidents. And I joined those. And once I was a member of those, I realized that we had to have a formal structure. So we registered as a charity, we formed a constitution, we wrote our plans that we had, I'm ex-RAF, so I'm used to having a plan ahead of the game, ready to turn up. So we train with the blue light people, the police and the fire brigade help us to train. And we had to become formal. And also we needed an audit trail, because when you're getting 80% money every time you issue kit, you need to be to have your finances absolutely in order. So we've got a very careful audit trail, which we show to the authorities every 3 months to make sure that we are transparent in our dealings.
And do you ever get asked to train other people, other Rotarians, other clubs from different areas of the country, knowing what you do?
Yes, we've just opened up in Wiltshire. We were only operating in Somerset. The Wiltshire authorities didn't come up with any money, so we went to the SSE, a major electricity generating company. They gave us the funds, so we're now doing the same in Wiltshire. Then we wanted to operate in Dorset, so we used the same organisation funds, and we now have a club in Dorset, which is going to help us to develop the same programme. And the reason why Minehead Club occurred is that Minehead is a real outpost within Somerset, quite difficult to get to within 2 hours. So we formed a mini EVAG in Minehead under the auspices of the Minehead Rotary Club. So they're operating in North Somerset, up on the coast, which is a major flood area, and they're very busy now. We keep them funded, keep them trained, and they have the kit.
So have you noticed an uptick in the needs for your services since it started in 2014?
Over the last 3 months, we've been almost overwhelmed by demand. And although we're a resilience organisation, we try to prepare people in advance. Emergencies occur, and you get a phone call at 6 o'clock in the evening. It's dark, it's already flooding, and people say, I'm in trouble. The floodwater's coming up the road. Can you help me? And you feel obliged to go out. So fortunately, I have an old Land Rover Defender, and when the water comes over the bonnet, I get a bit nervous. But a good example, recently I went to a house. The environment agency, the government, phoned me at 6 o'clock and said, there's a lady who's a single mother and the water's advancing in her house, and she operates a pump and she's run out of petrol. So I got an empty jerry can. I took the petrol to the house. The 14-year-old son ran out, and I said, here's the petrol. What are you going to pour it into? Old buckets, he said. I keep buckets of petrol in the house where I can get at it very easily.
Goodness me. That's resilience, isn't it? It's absolute resilience.
I gave him my jerry can. I said, don't you dare put this in a bucket. You'll blow your head off.
Goodness.
That was a funny incident.
Wow. Well, he's learnt a little bit of health and safety there from you. So have you found that your skills and your resources have been brought in to help with other situations that are emergencies other than floods?
Well, yeah, I operated at a reasonable level in an American company, working at Leiden, by the way, and Hazard Fada and Alphen, Avery Dennison. And I learned there to organize. I had to organize to succeed. And I'm also, I spent time in the Royal Air Force, where they really insist upon organization capabilities and prepare in advance for every emergency that could occur. So I was lucky there.
Harry, you're listening in there with interest, and obviously Holland's has its own flooding problems there. What did you make of what David had to say?
Well, we are surrounded by the dikes, and so to keep us our feet dry. But yes, it is very important, I think, because every now and then it turns out that even though we are surrounded by the dikes, it's sometimes not sufficient to keep us from flooding. And I think it's a good initiative. It should, it could be adapted elsewhere as well, how to run this thing, because, you know, when a massive amount of water is coming in, as we have experienced, I think it was in 2023 or something like that, or 22, when the southern part of the Netherlands was flooded, also Belgium, part of Belgium and Germany. And then these initiatives are very, very welcome to support the governmental system as well, because they can't do it on their own.
I just think it's great, David, that you've got this scheme, this Emergency Volunteer Action Group, and you can almost see its transference to Rotary across Great Britain and Ireland, but also beyond. Just the way that you've organised it, it's slick, it's sophisticated, and it's recognised as being a model of excellence. So there's certainly some transference which could go forward. What do you think about that?
Yes, I would like to see it occur, because there are areas where the public need help. One of the things that I most often hear when I go to visit houses is that you Rotarians are the only people who have come to help me. And it's very rewarding to be able to do it, and it's very good publicity for what Rotary does.
It is. So if you can paint us a picture of, let's say, a sudden flood and flood. Sorry, I'll say that again. A sudden flood happens. What is it that kicks you as a group into action?
We get a call out from the authorities, because we're listed as an organisation that it's capable and trained and ready to be called out. So when we get the call out, we turn out. Two people go out immediately, and then they do a reconnoitre. We take satellite communications with us in case there's a breakdown in communications. And then we call other Rotarians in as necessary to give us help. And we phone around the clubs and say, we need two people on Tuesday morning between 8 o'clock and 12 o'clock. Can you do it? And then we phone another club and say, we need two people 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock on Tuesday. And we build a program like that. And we operate that program each time that we are called out.
It's an incredible organisation you've got going on there. And I remember a previous guest saying, as a Rotarian, it's hard to say no. And in your situation particularly, you can't say no, can you, when you hear somebody's in desperate need?
Sometimes I want to, I have to admit.
Something?
Yeah, Harry.
Can I ask you? In Spain, they have this flooding, this severe flooding, a couple of years ago, in two consecutive years. Did they call on your help to how to manage this in Valencia or not?
No, they didn't. The only people who've called for help are the Lake District, Cumbria in UK, and Doncaster. When it occurred in Doncaster, we sent one of our members up and paid his expenses for a week, so you could teach them what to do. And he did that so successfully that the local authority offered him a job, but he's still up there. He never came back.
But that is what I'm saying again about the publicity, because really Valencia was going down under. And so this is, if they should have known, they could have asked it. And he afterwards, maybe not to help directly there and at the time of the flooding, but get them trained. how to practice.
And the point of what we do is we create resilience against the flood in the summertime, mainly ready for the winter, so that when the flood comes, there's no action, no emergency occurred, except for the householders to use the kit that we've supplied, and which they store in their house.
Right. And Garth, it rains a bit in Ireland.
It does. It certainly does.
What's the score with flooding there? Do you get much flooding in parts of Ireland? And can you see any use for this emergency volunteer action group in Ireland?
Yes, I do. I mean, we did. We actually had a flood appeal many years ago in the district, and it did cause great consternation amongst the district about who should get money and who shouldn't get money. And I suppose ever since then it hasn't really been too bad. But it certainly is just wonderful just to hear that. I mean, the amount of expertise and knowledge and all that there is just incredible that could be used.
We're very fortunate to be part of Rotary because Rotarians have got the skills, the organisational skills, to organise themselves in this way. That's why it's worked, because we've got Rotarians doing it. And also Rotarians are the sort of people who are willing to turn out when others might not, when it's raining and it's flooding.
It nearly sounds like, you know, just how Shelter Box started and just how it all
goes. Exactly.
That, so, yeah.
Yeah. And that was started in our county.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story, isn't it? With the Rotary Club of Helston was the sort of founding father. Helston Lizard was the founding fathers of Shelter Box around the millennium, and it's just gone on it ever since. And I got some emails today from them talking about their work now in Lebanon, and obviously helping with refugees over there. So it's difficult. Harriet, I forgot to mention when we were chatting about the European Action Summit in Rotterdam. This is your opportunity to plug that summit, September the 11th to the 13th. Off you go.
Yes, the European Rotary Action Summit in Rotterdam from 11th till 13th September. My theme is to belong. And because intuitively, deep in my heart, there are too many people disengaged. They don't feel seen, heard, and valued. They don't have a voice at the table. And I think Rotary can make that difference. And to get people engaged, to get them on board. So my theme is to belong. And there are three parts in it. The first one is to eliminate illiteracy. Because if you can't read nor write, others will tell you, they will be the president of your life. You will lose the leadership of your own life. So illiteracy is my primary goal. The second one is, as mental health has become a pandemic globally, and I think Rotary has the opportunity to get people on board, to get people engaged, of course. Apart from the professionals, most of us are not psychologists or psychiatrists, but to giving people that sense, you belong, I value you, that's so much important. And for the younger generation, environment is very important. They are they worry about what kind of world will we inherit from our parents. So with that in mind, I'm looking forward to see everyone in the beautiful, dynamic city of Rotterdam, which was rebuilt after the Second World War. It was completely bombarded. But they have a saying in Rotterdam, no words, but action. And I think that is really what fits the Rotarian. No words, but action. Let's roll up the sleeves and go to work. So it will be very dynamic, dynamic speakers. Yinka Babalola will be there and many other even your own and my own General Secretary Amanda Watkin will be over there as well. So it will be fantastic.
So now we know about two exciting gatherings coming up for Rotarians, Rotterdam and Dublin. We have them in the diary. Harriet, actually, I was going to ask you what you feel would appeal to younger people, but I think you answered that earlier when you said something completely mad. And I love that. And what is it that you feel we need to do to be completely mad and attract those younger members?
First of all, we have to ask them what they want. That is first, number one. And then they have the perception that they are heard and seen. And I think we have to get away from, I have nothing against the traditional clubs. I think that because on their shoulders we stand, but they have to do something complete weirdo, but well, with having our core values in mind. We're not going to become another organization. It's fellowship, diversity, integrity, develop leadership and service. That has to be in our DNA and not to take that away. But they have to do something which nobody expected to be, oh, that they will go like, is this Rotary? Then I want to join it. Completely out of the box.
And David, I would imagine that you must have some interest from the younger end, who really, they just want to help, like the 14-year-old you mentioned. He's helping his family with petrol in buckets. But do you find that people come and offer their help as families to what you're doing there?
Yes, EVAC is now recruiting non-Rotarians because other people are stepping up and saying, what you're doing looks worthwhile, I'd like to be involved. And then they learn because they understand the need for organization and planning. So it's a good learning exercise for them too.
You mentioned the EVAG. You've got a website, haven't you? If people would
yes.
like to contact you, where would they find you?
EVAG, EVAG at EVAG UK.
Wonderful. So we've got some diverse Rotarians on the call today, and it's absolutely wonderful. But what we always find when we talk to our guests is that there is that common thread that pulls us together. Like you were mentioning, Garth, that across the borders, you're just Rotarians in the Emerald Isle, and that's the world ride over what we feel is our common goal. And David, what would you say is something that you would love to see in 5 years' time, let's say by the convention in Dublin, what would you like to see as your organisation's progress?
That's a difficult question to answer because I'm not sure if all areas are equipped to take on the sort of role that we've developed. But if they are, they could provide an enormous service to the locality if they're in a flood area, because there's no other organisation anywhere that does what we do. Householders are left isolated and unhelped, generally speaking, and there's no plan for resilience. Households don't prepare in advance, even if they live in a flood area. So the service that Rotary could provide could be immeasurable in its value.
Just want to wrap up with one final question to throw to each of you, a nice little curveball. I'll go with Garth first, just to get Garth to sort of do a quick bit of warm-up and a few star jumps in preparation for this one. So Rotary talks a lot about service above self, but when you look back at your own Rotary journey, and I'll throw this at Harriet and David as well, can you think, Garth, of one moment which really captured that service above self phrase to you? Anything that springs to mind?
What comes to mind, I suppose, is our youth leadership development competition that we've run, that we've been running since, I think, 1991. And I mean, I've had the opportunity to go away with some of these 16 and 17-year-olds to Strasbourg to participate in the Euroscholar. And I suppose it's the uniqueness of bringing 20, 24 people, you know, along that don't really know each other. A bit worried, and some of them might not have been away from their families and things like that, to seeing them at the end of the 4 or 5 days when we finished with them, and how much they're all in tears and how they've bonded and how they've significantly developed, how they can speak in public. And it just sticks with you, makes you being proud to be a Rotarian mm-hmm. when you can see development of those young people who are our future leaders, who I'm hoping, as we're sort of in the alumni, to get them to be part of our team for 2031 in Dublin.
And David, how about you?
Well, it's twice a week, and I've had them 3 times this week. When you arrive at a house and you find people who are quite desperately worried about their future in their house, and then when you leave, they feel that they've been reassured that they have no protection against the next flood. and just to see their faces and the relief that they have is an experience in itself. So I get my highlights twice a week.
Harriet, when we talk about service above self, and when you look back at your own Rotary journey, what moment rekindles your memory?
I would say two things. When I was able to go to India for the vaccination, when I've seen what it made, the difference two drops can make in the future of children. That is the first one. But I must say, we always talk about what we are able to do via Rotary for others. But I will never forget the change Rotary has made in me, myself. I was a well-respected leader, but I must say Rotary changed me to become the leader I was supposed to be. And by that, I'm able to inspire other people because I have a story of my own to tell, how Rotary has changed me. And that is what attracts people when they hear the story from the heart. Then there is no age limit. I can speak to someone who is 17 years old. They get inspired, or someone is 80 years old, because it's my own life story, how Rotary has changed me, although I was a respected leader in my medical profession.
Well, thank you for inspiring us all, Garth, David and Harriet. And so as the studio clock begins tapping its watch and reminding us that airtime is not unlimited, we're once again obliged to bring this episode of Rotary Unscripted to a close.
Our thanks to Harriet Vervey, Garth Arnold and David Welsh for three fascinating conversations, and to Francesco Arezzo and Dr. Jamal Ahmed for those important reflections recorded at the Empolio Now event at the House of Commons.
And our thanks as always to the team here at Swindon 105.5 for keeping everything running smoothly.
And you can find this and previous episodes of Rotary Unscripted through Rotary Magazine, digital platforms, and wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So until next time, wherever you're listening, thank you for being with us. And our thanks as always to the team here at Swindon 105.5 for keeping everything running smoothly. So until next time, thank you, Garth.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Harriet.
Thank you so much for having me on the air.
On the air, and to David.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
So until next time, wherever you're listening, thank you very much for being with us.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Unscripted, the official podcast for Rotary in Great Britain and Ireland. If you'd like to find out more about Rotary or join us, visit rotarygbi.org. You can also read more stories in the Rotary magazine at magazine.rotarygbi.org. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then why not leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts? It helps to spread the word. And we'd love you to share this podcast with friends, family, and colleagues inside and outside of Rotary. You can also email comments or suggestions to editor@rotarygbi.org. This podcast has been recorded at the studios of Swindon 105.5.